Morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Hooten, Judge Smith, Judge Flaskamp Hallbrooks, the Honorable Carol Hooten presiding.
Good morning, Council. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The next matter on our oral calendar is the case of Gary Gruitt versus Victoria Labriola. The file number is A20-1627. This matter is being virtually handled today and is being recorded. Council, you each have 15 minutes for your oral argument. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And the appellant may proceed at this time. Please introduce yourself and your client before beginning your oral argument.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Mark Olson. I represent the appellant Gary Gruitt in this matter. This is an appeal from two separate determinations by the district court, one pertaining to a Rule 12 motion, the other pertaining to an award of sanctions. The only question on review of a judgment on the pleadings is whether the complaint sets forth a legally sufficient claim for relief. Where questions of fact exist, the court should not order judgment on the pleadings. A motion for judgment on the pleadings is not a favored way of testing the sufficiency of a pleading and will not be sustained by a liberal construction of the pleading where it can be held sufficient. When reviewing a dismissal on the pleadings, the reviewing court must consider only the facts alleged in the complaint, accepting those facts as true, and must construe all reasonable inferences in favor of the non-moving party.
If the pleadings refer to other documents and refer to other settlements, et cetera, I mean, those documents can be considered, can they not?
Yes, any documents that are quote unquote encompassed in the pleadings themselves may be considered, as well as under certain limited circumstances, the district court can consider matters from other court files depending upon the circumstances.
All right. So that the court, even on a motion to dismiss, can basically go beyond just the bare facts stated in the complaint, if the complaint references those other documents. Am I correct?
That is correct. In this particular case, it's not clear which rule the respondents were proceeding under. A Rule 12 motion can be brought under Rule 12.02E or under Rule 12.03. And they're separate and distinct mechanisms. The rule is clear under 12.02E. It cannot be brought once a pleading has been interposed by the opposing party in a matter. In this case, the respondents interposed an answer early on in the proceeding that predated their Rule 12 motion. While they reference 12.02E and 12.03 in their pleadings, thus the Rule 12.02 motion cannot be brought because of the answer being interposed. On the other hand, to bring a Rule 12.03 motion, the pleadings have to be closed. And in this occasion, the pleadings were not closed when the motion was brought. In fact, the time to amend pleadings didn't run until January 4th of 2021. And therefore, under the strict reading of both rules, the Rule 12 motion was not properly before the court. Now, there's been a responsive argument that these issues weren't raised below and therefore cannot be addressed on appeal. We take issue with that, and the issue we take is the challenge is in the form of a challenge to subject matter jurisdiction. And in light of that fact, the issue can be raised at any point in the proceeding, including on appeal for the first time. So we believe that it is properly before the court, any way you look at it, or as we have argued, in the interest of justice, it should be determined. Our position is the judgment itself is void because the court lacked jurisdiction to hear the motion. Again, regardless of whether or not the appellant raised that issue at the time the motions were heard. In conjunction with that Rule 12 motion, there is other authority that comes into play, in particular.
Mr. Olson, before you leave that specific topic, I just have a question.
Yeah.
Can you direct us to any authority that would create this analogy to subject matter jurisdiction in this particular context?
In the context of Rule 12 motion? No.
Yes.
There is no. And there's no discussion anywhere that we could locate after some pretty extensive research, but there certainly is. There is authority that talks about where rules of procedure prevent the exercise of jurisdiction over a matter. That creates a void judgment, as well as procedural irregularities can create a void judgment. And incurable jurisdictional defects can create void judgments. Now, again, the cases aren't Rule 12 cases, but they are general propositions of law, and they equate subject matter jurisdiction with those particular circumstances.
Okay, thank you.
With regard to the Rule 12 motion itself, there are other factors that come into play. In particular, when an answer has been interposed in response to a complaint, if there are material denials of material facts, if there are denials of material facts raised in the answer, Rule 12 relief is not available under any circumstance. And in fact, in this case, the virtual entirety of the answer that was interposed by the respondents is a denial of the allegations made by my client in this case. We're talking dozens of denials that are material denials. And therefore, Rule 12 relief couldn't be granted in this matter under any set of circumstances. Also, as Judge Hooten was discussing with regard to reference to matters outside of the pleadings, it's a limited category or limited categories of items that can be reviewed outside the pleadings and making a Rule 12 determination. All this court needs to do is to look at the issue of the March 22nd, 2014 email, which the district court heavily relied on in its decision to grant Rule 12 relief as being inappropriate and therefore as being grounds for reversal. The March 22, 2014 email was not referenced in the complaint. Fact of the matter wasn't referenced anywhere. It was a email that was attached as a fact document by one of the counsel for the respondents, purportedly in support of the motion for sanctions that was running at the same time the Rule 12 motion was going on. That particular memorandum, the declaration of Gene Morris, made it clear that it was supposedly only for the purpose of assisting the court with a determination on the issue of sanctions. But Judge Knudsen took that email, which wasn't part of the Rule 12 record, and made findings and conclusions from that email in support of the court's determination that or in support of its determination that, number one, there was a res judicata that prevented the grant of the Rule 12 relief, as well as the statute of limitations. Again, on that basis alone, the decision of the trial court should be reversed. And our brief sets forth page after page after page of other referrals to matters that weren't properly part of the record in this matter.
Mr. Olson, Yes. Returning to that argument, I'm just glancing at Judge Knutson's order. Can you direct us to language in his order with respect to the res judicata discussion that would indicate his reliance on that memorandum or email? Or is that taking you too far afield? I don't want to have you spend, you know, minutes.
It is, Your Honor. And it could be mistaken that the I know Judge Knutson in his decision referenced and broke down res judicata as well as statute of limitations, but his statute of limitations argument was, I believe, one paragraph long. It was very short. From our standpoint, it wasn't sufficient to sustain the determination. But in any event, I think it's on page 12 of the decision.
Mm-hmm.
My reference here.
You can look at that if you want to before rebuttal, so that I don't take the rest of your time up. It's so short.
Sure. Another aspect of a Rule 12 motion is the district court is prohibited from making findings of fact in its grant of Rule 12 relief. In this particular case, there are all kinds of findings of fact that were made by the trial court, including those that pertain to the March 22nd, 2014 email. As such, the decision of the trial court is erroneous and should be vacated.
Can I ask you, with regard to the your argument regarding the 12.02e argument, following that listing of the things that can be presented as a defense that can be made by motion, it says, a motion making any of these defenses shall be made before pleading if a further pleading is permitted. No defense or objection is waived by being joined with one or more defenses or objections in a responsive pleading or motion. How do you interpret that sentence? I mean, does that seem to say if you do have a responsive pleading and it does, there's other defenses, this doesn't prohibit you from going ahead and bringing it under 12.02e?
To me, that would be just an open invitation to disregard the rule. And my understanding of that particular sentence and that rule has always been, what it means is you can raise the failure to state a claim in an answer, which parties often do. But that's typically not the same as bringing a motion to dismiss, which is also permitted under Rule 12.02. Those are two separate things. If in fact, after pleadings are closed, a party believes that there's failure to state a claim, at that point in time, they can ask for a judgment on the pleadings. So my understanding of that wording in that particular rule is that if you identify, for instance, failure to state a claim as a defense in an answer, you can still pursue that even though you didn't bring a motion to do so. But the posture of this case is a motion, Rule 12 motion was brought. Not sure if that answers your question.
Well, I guess my question too is, what does it matter? If in fact they were able to show a failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted under either provision, what does it matter here? Because you're making a jurisdictional argument, and I don't know of any authority that indicates that there's no jurisdiction if you bring the same claim after filing a pleading.
Okay, if the court looks at, if Your Honor looks at Rule 1202, in the portion of the rule that follows the enumeration of matters that may be addressed by motion, it says a motion making any of these defenses shall be made before pleading if further pleading is permitted. Rules of construction deem that the word shall is mandatory.
Well, but the next sentence says no defense or objection is waived by being joined with one or more defenses or objections in the response of pleading or motion. That seems to open it up to, all right, you're not waiving any of this if you do have a response of pleading.
Well, I'll represent to the court that I spent dozens of hours looking into authority on Rule 1202 and 1203. And I can't recall any discussion of the no defense or objection is waived being an exception to bringing a motion before the pleading is interposed. And that very fact tells me anyway that a reading of it would be contrary to the intention of the motion and an intention of the mandatory provisions under the rule itself that the motion shall be made before pleadings are permitted. If in fact you can, I understand the court's argument that if it can be raised in a pleading, where's the harm? I mean, but we're talking different postures. We're talking about throwing a case out at the very beginning of the case based upon the complaint itself, as opposed to a party having a chance to develop a defense to the case. And if in fact a 1203 motion is brought after the close of pleadings, certainly the party responding to it would have a full opportunity after having developed a lot of these facts and issues during the case to address them. And the 1202E motion is a much stricter motion from the standpoint that it serves to defeat a party's right to even proceed with the action. On the other hand, a 1203 motion contemplates that the action has proceeded forward. Okay. Now, you said,
from that description, it sounds just like a timing issue as to when you can bring the motion.
Well, it is a timing issue. And I know there are arguments both ways, whether or not a timing issue is a jurisdictional defect that bars hearing the case or whatnot.
You have no authority that regarding this jurisdictional argument you're making, am I correct?
I have no authority other than the general authority. On the other hand, there is no Minnesota published authority that says you can do what the court is suggesting as far as it doesn't matter if you interjected a pleading or not, you can still bring a Rule 12 motion. Doesn't matter if the pleadings are all closed, you can still bring a Rule 12 motion. That's not what the rule says, and that's not what the case law says. There is some federal case law and federal authority that says no harm, no foul, but the difference is, I believe it's Federal Rule 12H B2, if I'm not mistaken, it's H2, that specifically allows for a Rule 12C motion, which is the same as a Rule 1203 motion under Minnesota law. So there's a specific grant of authority under federal law that would allow the court to entertain the motion under a no harm no foul. Minnesota doesn't have a like provision.
All right. Well, thank you. I think you're well over your time. So,
oh, I'm sorry. I don't see your time.
You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. Kroll.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michelle Keel, and I represent the respondents, Victoria B. Labriola, as trustee of the Victoria B. Labriola Revocable Trust and Labriola Investments. I want to start by focusing today on the three key issues in this appeal, which are whether the appellant has stated a claim to proceeds from the sale of the commercial property, whether he has a claim for rent allegedly received from the commercial tenant, and whether the trial court properly awarded sanctions. So first, the trial court correctly held that the claim for sale proceeds is barred by res judicata. This is most clearly seen from the fact that the appellant moved twice in the 2015 litigation to amend his complaint, once with the assistance of counsel, and then again on the eve of trial. He chose not to include the claim for sale proceeds when he amended with the assistance of counsel. And his second motion for leave to amend was denied because the trial court found that the late timing caused unfair prejudice to the defendants in that case. And he did not properly appeal the denial of that motion for leave to amend. So based on that, Mr. Gruitt cannot now claim that the denial of leave to amend somehow allows him to bring the same claim now in this subsequent litigation years later. It's clearly barred by res judicata, and it is really that simple.
Is that because, and I'm sorry, I'm not looking at that part of your brief, and I'm going back in my mind to law school, but was that a claim that had to be brought? I mean, the claim was not brought because the motion to amend was denied, right? And res judicata would apply to it because it was a claim that was what rising out of the same nucleus of facts or something and had to be brought? Like, what's the analysis that tells us that it's barred by res judicata?
Correct. So res judicata applies to any claim that was brought or could have been brought in the prior litigation. All of these claims arise out of the same property. We're looking at the same, you know, the 2006 mortgage document, the 2008 settlement agreement document. It's all the same documents. It's the same parties. It's the same commercial property. So it needed to be brought at that time.
And the at that time is in 2015?
Correct. I think it actually originated out of a conciliation court in 2013, but by the time it got to trial, it was 2015. So it's that case.
And that, I think, as I understand the argument of the breach of contract, is that, as I understand the argument, is that there were rights in the 2006 mortgage and the 2008 settlement agreement that provided for some portion of, and I understand you point out in your brief, there seems to be some dispute between the two or different provisions, but to some portion, half or all of the net proceeds of a sale. And so what I'm wondering about, if this sale...
You muted.
Oh, my apologies. If the sale occurred in 2014, how would it have to have been brought in a 2013 initiated action?
Well, so the point to that is that appellant has no interest in the property at all after February 2013. So any claim that he could have had would have had to arisen before 2013.
And see, the confusing part to me about that is the breach of contract claim is exactly that I'm entitled to some proceeds of a sale of a property following foreclosure. And the argument that your interest, your contractual rights disappear with a foreclosure doesn't make sense to me because you couldn't have a sale until after the foreclosure. Right? I mean, how could it be sold without the foreclosure?
So I think the point that I would make here is that both the 2006 mortgage and the 2008 settlement agreement contemplate an immediate sale upon foreclosure. Certainly the 2006 mortgage states that, and the 2008 settlement agreement also contemplates an imminent sale. So he knew in 2013 that his interest had been foreclosed, certainly. So if he thought that the documents required a sale and distribution of proceeds, he had the knowledge to bring that claim at that time and say that it needs to be sold now.
When were his... interest foreclosed, in your view? 2013?
February 28th, 2013 is when his interest was foreclosed, and that was found as fact by the trial court in the 2015 litigation.
And that's when the redemption period ended?
Period expired, correct.
Right. And so you're saying that at the time that the redemption period expired, he needed on that date, the date of the expiration of the foreclosure, prior to the sale, he needed to make a claim for sale proceeds at that point in time, prior to the sale. That's what I'm confused about. And this is not like the merits of whether it's right or wrong. I'm just trying to understand, like when I look at your brief about, for example, the statute of limitations, I know I'm switching topics a little bit, but you know, the argument I think that you make on pages 10, et cetera, of your brief are that, you know, it's barred by the statute of limitations because his interest is foreclosed at the end of the redemption period. And you go on to say, I understand essentially he's making claims for contract claims under the for sale proceeds, which happens later. And then you make a substantive argument about why that can't be, you know, there's a conflict, like maybe, you know, the mortgage is invalid because it's contrary to law and the 26 and 28 documents are inconsistent, et cetera. But that doesn't really go to the statute of limitations issue. And I think that I'm having the same question about statute of limitations as I am about res judicata. I mean, if the contractual claim is really based on the event of the sale and the non-payment following the sale, why does the foreclosure, why is that in 2013 dispositive of those issues, either on res judicata or statute of limitations grounds? It's confusing to me.
Well, again, I think the issue is that, you know, any claim that he could have had, whether it's for sale proceeds or not, it was a claim that was extinguished when his interest in the property was foreclosed in 2013.
Tell me why that is. Why would a claim for sale proceeds following foreclosure be extinguished at the point of foreclosure?
Because the foreclosure extinguishes his interest in the property. Nothing in the 2008 settlement agreement states that it survives foreclosure. The 2008 settlement agreement contemplated an imminent sale of the property, and it states if the sale did not occur as contemplated, you know, the parties would simply work together. But he still had obligations to, you know, make payments under the agreement, and nothing in there states that he can default on those obligations and then a year after foreclosure claim that he's still entitled to rights under the agreement.
So you're arguing just on that the contract itself doesn't provide what he's arguing. The 2008 settlement agreement doesn't give post-foreclosure rights to proceeds. Sort of a merits argument about what it means, or?
Well, there's several arguments that at play here, but that is one of them for certainly. But again, I would also want to highlight that he did amend his complaint in October of 2014 with counsel. And so that was well after the sale of the Rosemount property. So even if there was a concern about res judicata at the time the litigation was brought, certainly by the time he amended the complaint, he could have brought the claim at that time as well.
I see. And he didn't ask to add that claim in that amendment, which was, I take it from what you're saying, granted. Is that right? The amendment?
Correct. He did actually amend the complaint in October 2014 with the assistance of counsel, which was several months after the sale of the Rosemount property. And he did not include a claim to sale proceeds at that time. So that is, again, why res judicata would bar that. Then I would like to turn to the claim for rent proceeds.
Before we turn there, was the rationale that you just gave us about res judicata, did the district court make, is that a rationale that the district court relied on? Or is this an alternative argument by you?
I believe the district court relied on that. I mean, it certainly talks about how he had amended his pleading in the prior litigation. Okay. And so I believe it's in there. Then to the rent proceeds issue, the trial court also properly held was barred by res judicata and the statute of limitations.
Ms. Keel, can I just ask you a fundamental question about that? I thought that it was agreed that there was no rent after February. I thought that was conceded by appellants as well, and a finding made by the district court in that 2015 trial.
You're correct. That is a finding of fact in that 2015 trial. And so that is certainly one of the arguments why there should be no claim here. I understand appellant to be arguing, I think, that there's an allegation that the Labriolas thereafter received some rent in a subsequent settlement with the commercial tenant. But that litigation actually occurred, it's the judgment in the tenant lawsuit was entered in December 2013. So that would have been before the 2015 trial as well. And that judgment also is a matter of public record, properly subject to judicial notice and can be considered by the court even on a judgment, a motion for judgment on the pleadings as this is. It's the claim for rent would also be barred by res judicata as well, is a similar reason to the claim for statute of limitations, is that the tenant lawsuit was concluded and judgment entered in December 2013, which was well before the 2015 trial. So the claim could have been brought then, and the failure to bring it then precludes his ability to bring it now. There's also an argument in the brief by appellant that there's a partnership interest in the rent proceeds. And to that, I would just emphasize that the partnership that at one time owned the property was a partnership between Mr. Gruitt and John Labriola Sr. That partnership sold the property in 2006 to Gruitt and Victoria Labriola, basically as tenants in common. And so after that, there was no partnership interest. There was never a partnership between Victoria Labriola and Gary Gruitt. They simply owned the property as tenants in common, which does not create a partnership under Minnesota law. And so the claim to rent proceeds as a partnership asset is meritless as well. Then the last issue is the issue of sanctions, which is, of course, reviewed for an abuse of discretion. Mr. Gruitt's conduct here was clearly sanctionable. He's been bringing frivolous litigation against my clients for many years. These claims were clearly barred for the reasons that we've discussed today. And Gruitt has or should have known that they were meritless based on his long history with these litigation. Judge Knutson made a well-reasoned decision. He noted that previous attempts to deter Gruitt were unsuccessful. And based on his history with these parties, his decision was not an abuse of discretion and should be affirmed for that reason as well. The other arguments that appellant makes in the brief, he raises a number of procedural points. I don't intend to spend much time addressing those because they were not raised below. And in my view, the court should not reach those issues at all in its order.
So none of these Rule 12 issues were raised below before the district court?
No, there was never an argument that he was in any way confused about whether this was a motion to dismiss under 12.02 or 12.03. There was never an argument that any confusion led to a lack of subject matter jurisdiction. There was never an argument that certain documents shouldn't be considered by the court. All of those arguments do not need to be addressed by the court. I see that my time has expired, so thank you. I would just ask that the judgment be affirmed in all respects.
OK,
Could I want to ask one question, though. Do you believe that the judge's consideration of the email in this case was improper? I mean, obviously, the 2006 and the 2008 settlement agreements were referenced and they come into play, as well as the prior litigation. What about that email?
So the email, he does cite the email in the order. What I would say is it's basically irrelevant, because whether Mr. Gruitt had knowledge of the sale is not determinative for res judicata purposes. And so the reason the email was submitted was for the purpose of sanctions, because he claimed he had no knowledge of the sale. And certainly the email showing that he did have knowledge makes that conduct more egregious, but it's not necessary for a finding of res judicata.
And may I follow up, Judge Hooten?
Yes.
Is that because he should have, I thought the res judicata in part relied on the argument that he should have brought the claim relative to the sale, but now you're saying that even if he didn't know about the sale, that doesn't matter. I'm trying to harmonize those two ideas, how you would have to bring, and maybe, I guess, tell me about that. Like, why would he have to bring it if he didn't have notice of it?
Well, the case law that I believe we've cited in our brief states you actual knowledge is not required unless there's been some sort of fraud in concealing the claim. He whether or not you have actual notice doesn't affect whether the claim should have been brought in the prior litigation for the purposes of res judicata. And also, I would note that he did, at the very least, clearly know that his interest had been foreclosed, which, if he believed that required a sale and split of proceeds, should have led him to pursue that issue at that time as well.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Olson, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. And I see that I've got my clock up here this time, so I won't go over. First of all, with regard to this fraudulent concealment issue, I think the law is clear that you cannot summarily dispose of fraudulent concealment when you're arguing statute of limitations, that presents an absolute fact issue. It has to be determined by the finder of fact. With regard to whether or not these issues were raised
before, they might think we don't.
I think what counsel ignores is some of these issues didn't come to light until after the decision was issued, because for instance, the reference to the March 22nd email, that wasn't something my client knew was going to occur. My client didn't know the trial court was going to make findings in his determination and decision. Again, I would reiterate that we believe it's a jurisdictional issue with regard to whether or not the Rule 12 motion could have been brought in first instance.
Were any of those arguments raised below, though?
Well, the first two that I just cited couldn't be raised below because they arise from the decision itself. So how do you... My client's
not... Rule 12 issues, though?
Well, that's part of the Rule 12 issue. As far as the Rule 12 problems with what we refer to as jurisdiction or lack of authority were not raised below. I concede that. But from the decision itself of the district court, there are a number of Rule 12 objections that came out of it. And again, I, you know, reiterated the reference to an improper document, the making findings of fact and the determination. We don't get to any of these arguments counsel has made this morning regarding the merits of the res judicata or the statute of limitations and so on and so forth, if they're not properly before the court because the Rule 12 motion was not properly before. In any event, there's a big difference in the point of view from both sides as to what my client was attempting to litigate in the present action. My client, first of all, counsel refers to this motion to amend that occurred in October of 2014, and the conciliation court action became the district court action. My client's pleadings say he didn't know about it at that point in time. district court found otherwise, relying on a document that wasn't part of the record. So my client pled he didn't know about it. As far as when he did discover the sale, that's when he attempted to bring the motion to amend the complaint. His motion was denied by the court. With regard to...
But you would concede, Mr. Olson, that was not appealed, that decision.
No, it wasn't, but I don't think that had to be appealed, that particular decision. At that point in time, my client still didn't know what the proceeds from the sale were, didn't know any of the...
But you're not denying your client knew the property had been foreclosed.
No, at some point in time, he found out it had been. Oh, no, he knew it was foreclosed. But contractually, he was entitled to his share of the proceeds. We're not talking about his share of the interest in the property itself. And that's where all the hair splitting occurs and was argued to the trial court. He was entitled to his share of those proceeds, regardless of whether or not there was a foreclosure. That's what the contract said.
Which contract?
The actual 2008 settlement agreement.
So you rely on, that's what's confusing to me. Are you relying on a 2008 settlement agreement, which seems to say something different from the 2006 mortgage? Is that right? But you reference both. I'm trying to understand what your contractual claim is. Is it for all of the proceeds, net proceeds? Is it for half of them? Your complaint seems to say half of them, and it cites both documents. I don't know what the contract claim is precisely.
I didn't draft the complaint, but I don't recall the specific allegations. But I believe the specific allegations are that my client was entitled to one half of those proceeds. Now, counsel says my client didn't comply by making payments and so forth and so on. Well, those are set offs to any monies my client would be entitled to as far as the sale proceeds go.
And so you just are kind of putting together 2008 and 2006 as the contract claim. I was just trying to parse that out specifically what it was. I think that 2008 settlement agreement doesn't talk about foreclosures, I understand.
Okay, and if I could say one other thing, I draw the court's attention to 580.10. And with regard to the rent claim that my client made, that action was brought in Hennepin County. My client knew nothing about it. We know what the allegations were, and the allegations are they were seeking future rents in that action. And why else would they do a closed settlement agreement other than to hide that information from my client? Thank you.
Can I just ask you, I just want to go to the 2008 settlement agreement. And look, and I assume you're proceeding under section 2.8 of the settlement agreement. Am I correct on that?
I'd have to get to that agreement, Your Honor. Give me a moment. And unfortunately, I don't have my cheaters, and this is too small a text for me to
verify that. Okay. Well, it basically says the mortgage notes secured by a mortgage on G&K Family Limited Partnerships, one half interest as a tenant in common in the real property. However, for the purposes of settlement, they agree that they'll pay off this 2006 mortgage. And after that, the proceeds would be divided equally. So the way this is worded, It presupposes, and I assume as a precondition, that there be a 2006 mortgage still in existence. How do you respond to the argument that after that foreclosure, that mortgage no longer existed? So this paragraph, which was obviously drafted with the intent of getting that mortgage paid off, becomes meaningless.
Well, the addition of the wording in that foreclosure does not defeat my client's right to the proceeds would make that particular argument a nullity, because because
everyone knows that foreclosure terminates everyone's rights, but you're saying, oh, this case is different. But I'm not. So basically, I assume if there was a foreclosure, there was a non-payment.
And there were a series of non-payments, but you're saying notwithstanding that series of non-payments that merited the foreclosure, that your client's still entitled to 50% of the proceeds. And I mean, that seems to run afoul of the usual understanding of how foreclosure works.
Well, once again, we're talking about two different things. We're talking about an interest in the property itself and an interest in the proceeds from the sale of the property. And there, it's contemplated under 580.10, I believe, that where there are surpluses after a sale, after foreclosure, there remains certain rights. And in fact, in this case, there were contractual.
All right. Thank you. I think you answered my question. Right. And we will take the matter under advisement.